This summer marks the 150th anniversary of the Morrill Act, which in 1862 established the nation's land-grant universities. In contrast to private colleges like Harvard or Yale, these were called the People's Universities, dedicated to both education and research that would improve the common good. But as this system of public higher education has grown and evolved, it's also faced rising criticism, whether it's the constant budget struggles, ever-growing student debt, or the accusation that these venerable institutions are now out of touch with the real world. But according to our guest today, our nation's public and land-grant universities are still America's best industry. They educate 85% of those with bachelor's degrees, award more than half of the doctorates granted, and perform more than 60% of the country's academic research and development. We're talking this hour with Daniel Mark Fogel, former president of the University of Vermont, now an English professor there. He's also co-editor of a new book called Precipice or Crossroads, Where America's Great Public Universities Stand and Where they are going. The book examines this land-grant history, but it also looks forward at the troubles these institutions face and how they might find renewal. Today in the Exchange, modern challenges for these stalwarts of American public higher education. Let's hear from you. How well do you think the people's universities are doing, serving the people of today? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Or you can leave a comment on our Facebook page. And Professor Fogel joins us from Vermont. And Professor Fogel, great to have you. Thank you for your time.
Oh, pleasure to be here.
Well, let's go back to the Morrill Act 150 years ago. Seems amazing that given everything that was going on in July of 1862, they still managed to get this thing signed by President Lincoln.
Yes, it's an incredible thing. You're right. The nation was locked in a bloody civil war. Its outcome was by no means certain. The Union had taken a number of shattering defeats on the battlefield, and no doubt that was one of the reasons that the phrase "including military tactics" as the objects of study in the land grants was inserted into the act. President Lincoln signed on July 2, 1862. But they did it. They did it while the nation was tearing itself apart in bloody civil war. And they not only passed the Land Grant Act that created the great public universities, but they also passed the Homestead Act that opened up the West to settlement and the Transcontinental Railroad Act, which is also a land grant for the rights of way for the railroad. So they were really building the nation even in its moment of greatest crisis. It makes the political crisis today look tame.
Well, and they did it partly because of the tenacity and energy of a homeboy, Justin Morrill, right, a congressman from Vermont. Remind us just who he was and why he thought this was so important.
You know, Justin Smith Morrill was an ordinary Vermonter of humble background. He, like Abraham Lincoln, he didn't go to college. He became an advocate along with others, a professor from Illinois, Jonathan Baldwin Turner, and Horace Greeley, the editor of the nation's newspaper of record, the New York Tribune, for the application of scientific methods to the practice and the study of agriculture, partly because what they saw was American agriculture not being competitive, not being productive, certainly not at the level per acre that European countries were achieving, and many of them had institutions to train people in the latest soil chemistry, for example. So, you know, Morrill was a congressman who embraced this broad outcry in the nation for a new kind of post-secondary education that would be practical, that would be open to anybody from any walk of life and from any background, not just the white male elites.
Kind of sounds like our community colleges of today.
Like which colleges?
Our community colleges of today.
Well, in many ways it does, although, you know, many of the land-grant research universities have had, until fairly recent times, open admissions. But many of them are parts of systems like the Master Plan for Higher Education in California that integrate lifelong education of the people of the state, including the community colleges, the state colleges, and the University of California. So, yes, some of the democratizing impulse of the Morrill Land Grant Act now plays out on the stage of community colleges. No question about that.
And the thing that's so interesting about this is it wasn't just, I mean, for sure, it was about applying scientific methods to agriculture, training workers for the rising industrial revolution at that time. But there's also a lot of high-minded American ideals at play here. You know, this founding principle, right, of America as a meritocracy. You don't have to be an elite going to Harvard or Yale.
Well, yes, I think that's right. And it's interesting because there are two threads of political philosophy, if you will, that run through this. One is democratic and democratizing, and the other is meritocratic. And, you know, they meet at the point where you say everybody with merit, regardless of the walk of life he or she comes from, must have access to the meritocracy. But there are tensions. You know, it's very hard to get into the University of California at Berkeley. It's not, if you stack up how hard it is to get into the most elite and selective public research universities against, you know, the aspiration of Cornell University's founder that any person would find instruction in any study at the institution he founded, you can say there's a gap.
You know, and I definitely want to get into that idea that these land-grant universities, these public institutions of higher education, maybe aren't quite serving the public in the way that they were originally envisioned. But one more question for you about the history. Just to clear up, Professor Fogel, what's the difference between land-grant and public university or public college?
Well, you know, In legal and policy terms, an institution must have been designated as a land-grant college by its state legislature. And the 1862 institutions that were founded in response to the original Land-Grant Act in the latter third of the 19th century, all received their designations from their legislatures. So did the 1890 institutions. The Morrill passed a second land-grant act in 1890 that said, if you segregate your college, your land-grant college, you must establish in your state a second land-grant institution, either by designating an existing institution or creating a new one that will serve the black citizens of your state.
Post-Civil War.
That was 1890.
They sort of updated it, yeah.
Right, and then in the early 1990s, the tribal colleges were added to the system, too. So it is a formal designation. That being said, you know, many states have separate land-grant and non-land-grant public flagship research universities, Virginia Tech and UVA, for instance, or Texas A&M as the land-grant and UT Austin. Many other states have them all in one institution. The Ohio State University is the UVA and the Virginia Tech.
Well, let me invite our listeners to join us, and then let's fast forward to today, Professor Fogel. Our number here on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Join us as we look at 150 years of the land-grant universities, which really paved the way for our system of public higher education in this country. We're looking at how these universities and colleges are faring today, the challenges they face, the criticism that they faced. How well do you think these institutions, called the people's universities at their founding, are still serving the people? Join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Also, you can leave a comment on our Facebook page. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. And getting to today, Professor Fogel, you write that some see our system of public higher education, and I'm quoting here, as facing its moment of maximum peril. I read that and I said, wow, maximum peril. Is it that bad?
Well, I think, you know, there are many constraints that are holding back the potential of many institutions in American society. But as you quoted some of the data I provide in the book, 85% of the bachelor's degrees that are awarded to Americans in research universities are in the public research universities. 60 to 80% of the PhDs in areas of national need, over 60% of the academic R&D, much of the quality of life, extension of life expectancy, cure of disease, understanding of information technology and its use, things that have transformed our lives have come out of research in universities. And we have a moment now when there is enormous and increasing underfunding by the public of these universities, and at the same time increasingly increasing anxiety that the universities are either straying from their missions, that they're on an unsustainable economic course, that they're too expensive for students and families, and that their outcomes are not as good as we would like them to be, on a range of metrics like graduation rates.
We will definitely cover all of this after a short break and take your calls at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Join us as we look at the history and the future of our nation's public colleges and universities, 1-800-892-6477.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. And you only have until this Saturday at noon for the early bird drawing for NHPR's car raffle. So don't miss out on your chance to win $2,000 of gas gift cards from Irving Oil and help support NHPR at the same time. Go to NHPR.org to buy your raffle tickets or call 1-888-805-NHPR. New Hampshire weather today, mostly sunny statewide. Some clouds possible later this afternoon in southern parts of the state, highs 80 to 85 degrees. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from the 79th Annual League of New Hampshire Craftsmen's Fair, August 4th through the 12th at the Mount Sunapee Resort in Newbury. Information online at nhcrafts.org. NC DeCrest Center for Children with Disabilities, enriching the lives of children with complex medical and developmental needs and supporting their families. cdecrestcenter.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, former University of Vermont President Daniel Mark Fogel discusses the challenges facing our land grant and public universities. He's co-editor of a new book called Precipice or Crossroads, where America's great public universities stand and where they are going midway through their second century. Join us, 1-800-892-6477 is the number. How well would you say these institutions, which were called the people's universities at the start, still serve the people? How well do you think they're doing? How would you improve public higher education? 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Also, The Exchange is on Facebook. You can post a comment on our Facebook page. And Professor Fogel, before we go to the phones, you mentioned just before the break about the peril you see facing public higher education due to what you call the underfunding by our tax dollars of these universities. An article in the Chronicle of Higher Education last year said the root problem of public universities is not that they keep losing public funds, although the article says this is a problem. The root problem, this article said, is that voters don't know why public universities need public money. What do you think, Professor Fogel?
Well, I find that a little bit dumbfounding. I think people know that we need public money to support the cost of education, and they also feel very sharply how the decline in public dollars invested per student enrolled is being shifted as a burden of cost to students and families. You know, it's not that legislatures haven't increased their appropriations. They have by modest amounts. But it's that enrollment has gone up so hugely over the last, let's say, 70 years. I mean, in 1940, when we went into World War II, only 7% of the American people went beyond college at all. Between 1945 and 1960, that grew to 45%. In 2010, it was over 70%. So, you know, modest increases in state appropriations go hand in hand, unfortunately, with huge declines in the dollars per student.
So you think voters do understand that public universities need public money?
I think they do that. I think it's just that we've made a lot of promises to ourselves as a country, and it's hard to keep them all. And, of course, there are shifting priorities. In some states, including, unfortunately, Vermont, we now spend about 2.5 times on corrections what we spend on public post-secondary education. It used to be just the reverse, and it was just the reverse only 20 years ago.
In New Hampshire, the system of public education faced a huge cut this year, almost 50%. And as I understand, higher education has faced cuts in other states. I'm wondering if voters really do see the need of this, why they vote in people who don't want to fund public education, who see other priorities as more important.
Right. One reason is that the universities, and particularly the strong public flagships, have nevertheless kept their heads above water. And so I think people feel, well, if you're the University of Michigan or the University of California, Berkeley, or for that matter, UNH and UVM, you seem to be doing pretty well. Look at UNH. UNH has terrific, graduation rates by, over 75-76%, approaching 80%, way above the national averages. It has an extremely low loan default rate for graduates of UNH, so kids are getting good educations and they're going out and they've got the ethical strength and the career preparation to meet their financial obligations. That university is returning value to the people, and it's doing it despite these cuts. So I think it's easy for people to say, we can't let people who threaten our safety out of jail, and we've got to take care of our increasing aging population. We care a lot about health. We've got a lot of things we want to invest in, and the universities seem to be doing all right.
Let's take some calls and then a couple more questions in there for you, Professor Fogel. Let's go first to Annie in Pembroke. Hi, Annie. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Thanks. Great topic. I'm in the agricultural field, and I wanted to just see if your guest would mention the role of cooperative extension with these land-grant universities and how important they are to disseminating the information that the university generates to the general public. And I'm always astounded at how willingly the political people in charge are wanting to cut cooperative extensions budget or even try to eliminate them, because it seems to me that that's one of the more valuable tools the land-grant universities have.
So the cooperative extension that gives advice to not just aspiring farmers, but even backyard gardeners, all sorts of advice there, Annie. I've heard, though, that cooperative extension is now using technology to try to get out into more communities, and that's a way that they've become more efficient.
They have become more efficient, but in this last budget go-around, they basically shut down Stratford County's, each county has an office. They shut down Stratford County's and other ones. They just take a look and say which ones are least effective and cut them down. And they don't realize some of the many, many skills that these cooperative extension has. And I'd like to see cooperative extension. I mean, they already give small business help, for instance. I'd like to see them. They do a lot with food safety and such. I'd like to see them, be a role of disseminating information of all the information the land-grant universities put in, instead of just sticking with agriculture, because they put it in ways that people can really directly apply to their lives.
Okay, and thanks a lot for calling in. Cooperative Extension. Go ahead, Professor Fogel.
Well, that was very eloquent, and I agree. The Cooperative Extension services throughout the nation are very important. Like every other domain within universities, they have to be well managed and managed as efficiently as possible, and we can't do all the things that we used to be able to do. And you can look at our region and say, well, we need to cooperate as much as possible. We send our soil samples from Vermont to a lab at the University of Maine. We send our milk samples for mastitis testing to a laboratory at Cornell. We need to be not to have unnecessary duplication. How many blueberry specialists do we need in New England? And we may not be able to have an office in every town. But the mission is terribly important, and it's important for supporting agriculture and the health and well-being of rural communities. And, of course, it reaches into our towns and cities as well. I mean, there's a strong 4-H urban movement supported out of our colleges of agriculture and life science and the statewide extension services. So we believe in that. It's very challenging to maintain it at its current levels without fees for services when federal funding has really stagnated and the value of those federal dollars and constant dollars has declined hugely over time.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that then. Fees for services. And for sure, if you want to use extension services, you're annoyed by that. But most people, you know, or lots of people anyway, live in the suburbs or the city. They don't have gardens. They don't need advice from 4-H or blueberry specialists. So maybe people who do need soil samples or blueberry advice should pay a higher fee. Why should anybody else contribute to that?
Well, perhaps, you know, a copay never hurts, but you want your basic bedrock funding in your insurance. I mean, taxation is a form of insurance for the nation to cover needs. The taxes that go to the federal government and come back to support the extension service are benefiting everybody in broad terms. It's a little bit like the taxes that support public schools. Not everybody has a child of school age, but everybody benefits. And we know if people drop out of school in middle school, we're going to have high costs and corrections down the road to everybody.
Yeah, I guess I'm seeing the connection with public education, but maybe less so with this more specialized advice that Extension gives.
Well, you know, I think I would certainly support co-pays of some kind and a fee-for-service arrangement where that makes sense. I would want to keep them as low as possible and to see the society underwrite the common weal as much as possible. I mean, Lord knows our people who work in rural communities and in the agricultural sector in Vermont have enough challenges and are barely clinging to family farms without us helping them as much as we can.
Our phone number again on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. We're looking at the history and the modern role of the nation's land-grant universities and system of public higher education. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And thanks for that call. Let's go next, Professor Fogel, to Charles waiting in Warner. Hi, Charles. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning. I just wanted to say a few things. First of all, I am very pleased with my son's education at the University of New Hampshire. He has received a great education, and we're very pleased with what he's received to date. He's a senior this year. My issues are, one, the New Hampshire legislature, as previously mentioned, cut funding by 50% in the last legislative session. And this is a major concern about prioritizing the use of state funds. I'm concerned about the average cost. I may be off by a little bit, but it's about $26,000 a year to attend the university, and that's full tuition, room, and board, which is extremely high for a state school. Other schools around the country are substantially cost less for a public institution. And a major concern is the cost of housing. If you take five students, again, a generality, five students pay about $6,000 a year times, you know, five times 6,000, $30,000 for a suite.
So it's expensive, Charles. I wonder what you think the answer is.
Excuse me?
Charles, I wonder what you think the answer is to these costs that you're, you know, that it hurts to pay.
Well, I think, first of all, the state of New Hampshire has to step up its support to university. It's just not acceptable for the legislature to cut 50% of their support in this past session. I also think that the university can do some cost cutting as well. So there needs to be a partnership between the state and the university and assess their costs, but do that in a spirit of cooperation, which I did not see this year.
Okay, Charles, thanks a lot for calling in. Lots to talk about there, Professor Fogel. Boy, the price tag is a big deal. And while college costs are going up everywhere, Americans do seem especially galled at the price tag at their public universities, which are supposed to serve the people. What do you think about, first of all, Professor Fogel, our caller's main point? It's just too expensive, and it's the costs aren't being addressed in a cooperative way.
Well, I first of all, I empathize, and I feel very strongly that while most of our public institutions are able to build very strong safety nets for the neediest students, those who are eligible, for instance, in the means-tested federal Pell Grant program, the middle class is getting squeezed very hard. But, you know, it's not that the universities, contrary to many reports, have been poorly managed or that they are spendthrift. That charge per student for the suite in the residence halls is, I would, you know, I don't know the finances of that particular set of residence halls, but I would bet anything that the prices are based on what is required to service the bond debt and to maintain and operate the buildings, including the programmatic operation of the buildings, student affairs staff, residence hall staff, residential advisors, and so on, being on hand, the administrative support for that. But they're not there to make a profit. These are nonprofit institutions, and they are keeping their costs as low as they can because they're in a very competitive universe. And in fact, if you look at constant dollars from 1985 to 2010, the operating costs for education at public research universities have gone up only 0.4% per year per student. 0.4% per year per student.
So why is tuition going up 8%?
Or more.
Right.
Because it is, because for a variety of reasons, including the, you know, the easiest to graph and the most dramatic is the decline of state appropriations per student against a rising, in part driven by a hugely increasing number of students seeking access to the institutions. From that point of view, they are fulfilling the democratic mission-driven thrust of the Morrill Land-Grant Act. I mean, look at the U of California. Last year, they had a cut that amounted to 23% of their state appropriation for the campuses of the University of California, and their tuition went up 21%. That is squeezing the middle-class students especially hard in California. But they really had no choice.
Well, some people say they do have a choice. We talked to House Speaker Bill O'Brien last week, and he said, look, you know, we cut their funding, yes, but they did not have to raise tuition here by, I think it was 8.7%. He said, I'm quoting, much more than was necessary to absorb the cuts in spending. We cut across many agencies, some as heavily as UNH, and none of them reacted the way UNH did. He said UNH has increased its tuition every year for the past 30 years. I don't want to draw you into a New Hampshire argument here,
but let me speak about the plight of these universities generally.
No, but what I'm saying is the idea is universities don't have to respond this way. They have other choices. That's the idea.
I guess that is the idea. But, You know, show me another industry that has increased its costs by not two or three times the rate of inflation as we're often accused of being, but less than 0.4% of the rate of inflation for a quarter of a century on an annual basis. The costs have not gone up that much. It's that the burden of bearing those costs has been shifted to students and families. Some of it's the cut in state appropriations. Some of it's the underfunding of research contracts with the federal government. And that's against the inflationary costs of maintaining campuses that are hard to maintain and aging and so on, and maintaining information technology infrastructures and so on. It's just a very expensive business. And I think the difference between UNH and let's say, the division of motor vehicles is that the DMV has a monopoly in New Hampshire, right?
Yes. And it,
but UNH doesn't have a monopoly. It has areas where it has world-class programs, and it competes for faculty and students on a global basis. The kid who's booked for a world-class program at UNH can also go to many other public and private universities that have a lot to offer, too.
Makes me wonder, maybe UNH and other, you know, land-grant or public colleges and universities should just focus on what they do best. Maybe they shouldn't try to be all things to all people.
Well, I don't think they can be all things to all people. That's why we have a system of comprehensive master's levels, public institutions and community colleges, and they all fit together. And we're very, you know, in Vermont, we have a wonderful community college of Vermont. It's become the biggest feeder school for the University of Vermont.
Right. We've seen a similar trend here in the Granite State. And lots more to talk about, Professor Fogel. We will take more of your calls after a short break. You can email us, too, at exchange@nhpr.org or leave a comment on our Facebook page. And we'll be right back.
This is NHPR, where support comes from you, our members, and from the Mount Washington Auto Road, located on Route 16 in Pinkham Notch, where you can live free and drive to the world above treeline, mtwashingtonautoroad.com. And from the merchants of Mill Falls Marketplace in Meredith, proud to support the Winnipesaukee Playhouse's production of The Last Night of the Ballyhoo, August 1st through the 11th. This is NHPR.
Today on Word of Mouth, the limits of look but don't touch. An educator argues that the best way to learn about the environment is through hands-on experience. And a dark comic novel pokes at the exposed midriff of a high school cheerleading squad. I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth will BEAGGRESSIVE. Be aggressive today at noon and again at 9 on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, NHPR President Betsy Gardella answers your questions and comments. You can email us your questions for Betsy before the program if you'd like. exchange@nhpr.org is the address. And join us tomorrow morning, live at 9. Today, we're looking at the 150th anniversary of the Morrill Act, which created our nation's land-grant universities, lay the groundwork for our system of public higher education in America. We've been talking about that history, but also looking at the many challenges this system of public higher education faces today. Join us with your questions or comments. How would you improve American public higher education? What do you think the system still has going for it 150 years after its founding? Our number, 1-800-892-64. Our guest is Daniel Mark Fogel, English professor at the University of Vermont. He served as president there from 2002 and 2011. He's co-editor of a new book about America's public universities. And Professor Fogel, before we go back to the phones, I want to return to something you raised earlier when we were talking about the money and the extreme problem that you see by reduced state and federal support. You said one of the problems is that despite the cuts, universities seem to be, quoting you here, keeping their heads above water. And certainly you do see, you know, university presidents saying, look, you know, this cut is bad, but we're stepping up our resolve to get private money in. So is that a new model? I mean, is that the way these universities need to go?
It is a new model, and it's one that is embraced by many of us in public higher education out of necessity, but with a sense of great regret, too, that we are in danger of sacrificing some of that very democratic public mission that was the core of the land-grant impulse. You know, despite the big cuts at the University of California, there are four schools out there, Berkeley, UCSD, UCLA, and UC Davis, each of which have more Pell Grant recipients, each one of which, than the entire Ivy League combined, all eight schools, some of them pretty big, like Penn and Cornell. So we still are agencies of democracy, but as we are forced to be more market-driven, to rely more on tuition to maintain competitive world-class instructional laboratories, classrooms, research laboratories, medical schools, and so on, we are in danger of becoming harder and harder for ordinary middle-class people to access.
As we rely more on tuition to make up
as
for those
we rely
cuts.
More on tuition. And so there is potential great danger to the mission as you push the universities toward a market-driven privatization.
What's wrong with private funds? I mean, if you don't want to hurt the students, you don't want the state
funds.
Money. Yeah,
they're tremendously important to us. The UNH Foundation has done a great job of bringing resources to New Hampshire's university, and so has our development effort at UVM. But, you know, most of the private dollars in public universities are restricted. They're given for a particular purpose to support, you know, a particular professor's research in the medical school on sentinel node biopsies, which have been a great advance that has saved lives, the lives of many victims of breast cancer that came out of the University of Vermont. Somebody will give money just for that. Well, a restricted gift doesn't help you operate the university in general. It helps you do a lot of wonderful, wonderful things. And many of our restricted gifts are, of course, these days aimed at scholarships for students to support them. So all of them help. All of them are tremendously valuable, but they are restricted. And, you know, typically a public university that raises $200 million may raise $1 or $2 million of that that's unrestricted giving.
Our phone number again is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. How well would you say these institutions, called the People's Universities at their founding, are still serving the people? Let's hear from you. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Leave a comment on our Facebook page or email us, exchange@nhpr.org. And Professor Fogel, here's an email from Wayne, who says, a friend of mine who's in charge of residential programs in another state tells me they never have budgeting problems in their department because it is the one real profit center at the university. The costs are high because they're being used to subsidize losses in other aspects of the university. I'm not saying this is wrong. There are many cases of businesses that use stronger profit centers to subsidize weaker ones, but it does distort the real picture and drive up costs. That's an interesting point, kind of picking up on our caller earlier who was having a hard time covering his son's education. What do you think? And Wayne, thanks for the email.
Yeah, I can't comment on the situation at the institution where Wayne's friend is in residential life. Most housing programs at universities are run as auxiliary operations or income expense activities. It's fairly rare, in my experience, but it may have happened at the institution where Wayne's friend works, that the accounts of one auxiliary are used to support accounts of other auxiliaries or the general fund of the university. Now, sometimes, you know, you have big-time athletics that carry all of the risks that we've seen play out at Penn State in spades, also sometimes produce profits. I used to be at Louisiana State University. That's one of the 16 athletic programs that makes money. They just gave $5 million to the university for the general fund in the last couple of weeks. But that's very rare that an auxiliary enterprise will have funds siphoned to support weaker areas of activity.
Wayne, thanks a lot for the email. And here's another one that just came in. This is from Tom in Rye, who says, would your guest care to comment on the role of tenure in institutions of higher learning? Tom says, it is, in my opinion, a major contributor to the cost issues in universities and colleges and contributes to misaligned incentives. He also wants to know, Professor Fogel, if you're a tenured professor. Tom, thanks for the email.
Yes, I've been a tenured full professor of English since 1984, so obviously my point of view on this is not disinterested.
That's all right. You're upfront about it.
I think that tenure has its costs. There is a price we pay. There is the inevitable accumulation of deadwood. It makes it hard, easier for the faculty to resist change, including needed change. But you know, I think many of us feel, and I do very strongly, that the costs, the price we pay for having tenure is far outweighed by the benefits we get. You know, something interesting happened after the Land-Grant Act. The modern research university developed, and it was really a fusion of a German model of graduate education tied to research with an English model of residential undergraduate colleges, and those two things put together. And that really happened in the latter half of the 19th century, and it's been a key to America's strength, America's prevailing in the world wars, to have this educated citizenry, to have the scientific and technical and industrial know-how, to have the engineering schools as well as the ag schools, to have our preeminence in the physical sciences in the nuclear age, et cetera. That came out of our universities. And so the idea that you can abandon the values of the research university and preserve the benefits to American society of having these institutions is a very high-risk proposition. The research university is based on a belief in the disinterested pursuit of truth.
And tenure helps protect that? Is that what you're saying, related
absolutely,
to Tom's email?
Absolutely, it does. I mean, if you're a chemist working for Dow Chemical or Pfizer or Merck, they tell you what to work on. They give you a timeline, and if you don't solve that problem, you're off the problem. You're off the project. In a university, if you're a chemist, you follow your nose. You make basic discoveries. They may have applications that we haven't dreamt of yet, but that will change everybody's lives for the better. But you have to be able to have academic freedom depends upon a level of autonomy. Look, I mean, I've worked in states where commodity agriculture is very important. So I sort of felt the pain of a dean at the University of Minnesota, who, writing about the Land-Grant Act and about academic freedom, told a story. He was an agricultural economist, of how the dairy industry had tried to get him fired at the university as a professor because he came out against price supports for milk. Well, dang, I can believe that. I know how powerful commodity agriculture was at the University in Louisiana. Academic freedom is very, very important, and tenure is a way of securing that. It's also a way of getting the chemist to work as an assistant professor at UNH or Vermont for $60,000 or $70,000, who could be, you know, making much more than that.
It's a reason for someone of high quality to stay. Tom,
tenure
thanks again.
Tenure has an economic value that compensates for the compensation that people who could make much more in the private sector.
Let's take another call if we could. This is Carol in Grantham. Hi, Carol. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, yes. Thank you. What I am seeing both in New Hampshire with this current legislature and in fact, nationwide, I think with what we would now call the base of the Republican Party, there's a very strong anti-intellectual component and a very definite anti-science component. And part of that is a stated intent to destroy public education. They say it's not in the Constitution, so why should we pay for it?
Wow, that's a big statement, Carol. You're saying Republicans want to destroy public education?
Yes, that's what I'm hearing. And
they want everybody to be dumb?
I think if you will recall the woman from the Tea Party movement who was on your program a couple of weeks ago, she as much said so.
Well, Carol, thanks for calling in. And what do you think? Is there a political element to this, Professor Fogel?
Well, I won't comment on the on that statement in terms of the partisan vectors bristling out of it. There are plenty of Republicans who support higher education and who sit on the governing boards of universities with a great commitment to their public missions and to the value they create for their states and the world. So I think there's always been in American culture a strong strain of anti-intellectualism. And at the same time, we have built a higher education system that is the envy of the world. You know, Fareed Zakaria says in one of his recent books that higher education is America's best industry. Thomas Friedman has made similar statements in his books about global, you know, about geopolitics. So I think there is a strong anti-intellectual strain, but who's winning most of the Nobel Prizes in the sciences and medicine?
You know, we've talked a lot, Professor Fogel, about money coming in and some of the trouble with private grants and the decline in state or federal funding. What about the expense side, though? I mean, again, the idea that public universities have really expanded their mission, trying to be all things to all people, trying to offer all that the private colleges and universities offer. Is this a moment in time where public higher education needs to really focus in and say, yes, we should do that, and no, we really can't do that right now? Sorry, you're going to have to find it somewhere else.
Well, sure, but obviously at a cost and certainly at the nation's peril. I mean, what do we do that the private universities don't do? We educate a lot more students. As I said, 85% of the bachelor's degrees awarded to students who go to universities or go to the public graduates of public universities. We're the place, by the way, that the companies that are seeking employees want to come. When the Wall Street Journal did a list of the top 20 schools where corporate recruiters like to go, only three of those were private. And one of those three was Cornell, which is the land grant in New York State, despite its being private. And so, you know, we play just a huge role in the economy. I would like to hear what people think we're doing that we shouldn't do. And then we could talk about those things one by one. Do we want to stop training doctors? Do we want to stop training plant and soil scientists and plant biologists? Do we want to stop being the place where we educate the Norman Borlaugs, who drove the Green Revolution with new strains of wheat?
It's easy to say, you know, we should narrow the scope, focus the mission, but then when you get down to what are you going to do and what aren't you going to do, people start to get upset.
That's exactly right.
I wonder about technology, Professor Fogel, too. There are those who say that private schools have done a better job jumping on the technology bandwagon and using that as a way to, A, increase efficiency, B, reduce costs.
Well, you know, there's what's called the double-edged Matthew effect, where the poor get poorer and the rich get richer. Jumping to all kinds of technology with bells and whistles takes a lot of money. And the elite private universities have much, much more money than even the most elite public universities. You know, the difference is like $25,000 in endowment per student at an elite public research university, and $800,000 or $1 million in endowment per student at an elite private university. So the resources are there to jump much faster. That being said, I see that places like Stanford are going to continue to offer world-class residential undergraduate and graduate education. Nobody's going to want to learn chem engineering or orthopedics over a computer. You've got to be there. You've got to be at the bench in the lab. You really need, and even in the humanities, certainly in the arts, to be in interaction with your teachers, and often in a physical way and in a physical space.
Well, and Professor Fogel, even though you didn't join us physically, I appreciate you joining our conversation and being with us today.
It's a pleasure to chat with you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Joining us from Vermont again, Daniel Mark Fogel, English professor at the University of Vermont, where he served as president from 2002 until 2011. He's co-editor of the new book called Precipice or Crossroads, Where America's Great Public Universities Stand and Where They're Going Midway Through Their Second Century. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime.